Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
From surgery to success, Carlos Sainz recovers from his appendectomy to lead a famous Ferrari 1-2 in Melbourne. You're listening to the F1 Strategy Report. My name's Michael Laminato, and this is Round 3, the Australian Grand Prix. Carlos Sainz is the only driver not named Max Verstappen to have won a Grand Prix in the last 20 races, after dominating at Albert Park in a pleasingly competitive Ferrari. Starting from the second row, Sainz was at his rapid and calculating best to take the lead in the first two laps. Verstappen, the pole-getter, was hamstrung by a stuck rear right brake that soon put him explosively out of the race. But Ferrari's pace was good enough to have vied for the victory on merit. With Verstappen out, it was McLaren who became Ferrari's closest challenger, but Lando Norris and Oscar Piastri fell only just short of disputing a perfect finish for the Italian team. So let's take a closer look at some of the key moments of the Australian Grand Prix with Phil Horton from Auto Week. Phil, it's good to see you.
Good to see you too, Michael. And 3 years in a row, we are facing each other doing
yes,
this.
Very exciting. It is thrilling. You could be in a remote studio, but not this week.
We could be.
This week, we are on the ground in Melbourne at we're not at Albert Park right now, but we were at Albert Park to witness the Australian Grand Prix, to witness for only the second time in 20 races, Max Verstappen not winning a Grand Prix, which is, I mean, that's history in the making. We're all going to be talking about 10 in a row. This is my preferred history.
Yeah. I mean, I think when we saw the first lap and, you know, Max Verstappen a second clear of the rest, we thought, well, here we go again, settle down for another 57 laps of car number one being miles out in front. But then it all changed.
So before we get into exactly how this race was decided, this was unusual by the performance standards we've come to expect, not only over the last year, but even over the first two races where we'd all come to expect the Red Bull Racing is the fastest car by a greater or lesser amount, and everyone else is just trying to pick up the crumbs. This is the third year of this layout. The track surface is quite smooth as well. It was resurfaced a couple of years ago. How much was this down to Albert Park being a little bit of an outlier, if we can still call it that on a 24-race schedule where there are a lot of outliers these days? And was this interesting race, aside from obviously the unreliability issues for Max Verstappen, a sign that maybe this track is, I guess, maturing a little bit into one that's a bit more raceable than the previous layout?
Yeah, I think that while obviously Max Verstappen's retirement was a great spectacle, opened up the race, the one frustrating element is obviously not being able to see how that battle between him and Carlos Sainz and even Charles Leclerc and Lando Norris would have played out had he been in the race, because we've seen previous years this is not necessarily the strongest Red Bull circuit. I think 2022 they didn't win, 2023 they were, well, certainly Max was less dominant while Checo was all over the shop, and that kind of continues a trend of street tracks, maybe slightly lower grip, softer tyres. And we saw it from the start of practice on Friday that Ferrari were a lot closer or indeed ahead of Red Bull. So that is the one frustrating element, that the circuit does appear to be more raceable. It's still not the best track for overtaking because now it's faster and there's not really many braking zones anyway. So there's quite a few lunges. It's quite a narrow track, even with the expansion that happened in 2022. But yeah, the one frustrating element is we got a good result. Not necessarily a enthralling race within the context of, wheel-to-wheel battles, but just interesting because it was someone different up front, basically.
It's a bit of a backhanded compliment, isn't it, that this was the best race of the season so far. And it was a reasonably good race. There's some strategic intrigue, but not a lot of wheel-to-wheel action, which does tend to be the case at Albert Park. Largely, the excitement was from the fact this was a two-stop strategy opposed to one, which meant there were a couple of extra windows of jeopardy as opposed to Albert Park usually, which is you sort of stop around lap 20 and you're good to go for the rest of the race, and it's normally a bit of a grind from there. I want to talk about Red Bull Racing a little bit more, though. You sort of mentioned there that these are increasingly the kind of tracks that they're a little weaker at, not always weak. That might sometimes be the wrong way to say it, but a little bit less advantageous perhaps for them. We didn't get to see exactly how they were going to go in Max Verstappen's hands, at least. Sergio Perez too was slowed by some debris under his car, which meant we didn't get maybe the truest performance picture on Sunday. But it's fair to say that didn't have a great build-up to the weekend either. Looked sketchier than usual. Where did it go wrong and why did the team find it so difficult to master Albert Park this year?
I think, you know, we're talking about the context of it going wrong. Max Verstappen still took pole position and Sergio Perez was third on the grid before his penalty for impeding Nico Hülkenberg. So obviously on Perez's side of the garage, it goes wrong that he's then sixth. He's stuck in that dirty air a little bit more. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the debris or the floor damage that was picked up in the first stint. So that's kind of that negative cycle. But I think even from first practice, you know, you saw, I think both Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, even if you go back to testing, Max Verstappen gets in the car, maybe less so Bahrain, but was fairly happy straight away with the handling, with the balance, with everything. Here, there was a little bit of, oh, I'm not quite happy. Oh, there's, you know, those occasional messages, well, the downshifts feel funny. So it was never really 100% feeling with the car. And the fact that he was a few tenths ahead in qualifying was maybe a bit of a surprise that Ferrari, considering usually their qualifying pace is a little bit stronger than their race pace, relatively speaking, that Ferrari were a little bit further off. That was probably a bigger surprise than necessarily Max taking pole. But yeah, you're right. It continues this trend of this type of circuit that, you know, not, they're not weak. They're still pole position. And we don't know where Max would have been because his race never happened. And historically, we know that there's a gap to Checo such that, you know, just because Checo's fifth doesn't necessarily mean Max would have been only fourth. He might still have managed a two-stop strategy quite well. We don't know. It's all hypothetical. But yeah, it's this trend of Ferrari being closer or Red Bull being closer to Ferrari at circuits like Melbourne. You know, I think we mentioned when we were talking on Sunday about how you look back at last year and it was Melbourne, Montreal, Singapore, obviously, famously, they didn't win where they did struggle. And Las Vegas, where that dominance that, you know, you think of the next race at Suzuka, it would be a surprise if Max didn't disappear up the road. Circuits like that where they've absolutely annihilated the opposition, even with a dominant car, they've been reined in at these types of tracks.
It is interesting that, like I was sort of saying, they're tracks that have been such outliers on the calendar typically, often because of the street element, right? Historically, not a lot of street circuits in Formula One, but as that number increases, we can see a trend just about when maybe we previously wouldn't have been able to see one. So that's quite interesting. It'd be interesting. Miami might be the next
similar-ish. But the thing with it's that street circuit or not a street circuit,
because
you think that's effectively a permanent track, and they resurfaced it after the first race
when
because
it was
breaking up. And when you think Jeddah's similar in that it's a street track, but not a street track, it's quite high grip and very smooth, that it's almost like a permanent track just with walls very close.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what tracks this happens on, because it is also worth putting into context that this is round three, and obviously the first two rounds appeared conclusive based largely on the fact that last year was so dominant for Red Bull. But there is a chance actually we'll find circuits we haven't been to yet that could throw up weaknesses that we hadn't foreseen. So there is always that element, but I want to look at the Ferrari side of this thing, because from the moment they rolled out in Friday, appeared to be quite competitive, particularly by the end of Friday, looked pretty good. Has been the second quickest car all year, so that has paid dividends at the race where the quickest car has been a little bit weak or a little bit off its game. We talk about the fact that Ferrari didn't get pole position, but I want to put this in the Carlos Sainz context, who ended up winning the Grand Prix from the front row of the grid. 16 days, he won this race after being in surgery. He talked on Saturday about this. I've been saying this to everyone, but the weird feeling of his internal organs moving around because there's a little bit more space inside. Sorry if people don't like hearing that, but I find that very fascinating. How big a performance was this for him, considering the number of unknowns there were in this race, both from the race perspective and his own perspective, to be able to be, I guess in his words, such a smooth operator for the course of qualifying to the Grand Prix?
I think you'd be hard to argue against the fact that this is probably his finest weekend-long performance in Formula One. You know, you look back historically, he's not necessarily been someone with outstanding one lap pace, particularly alongside Charles Leclerc, but he was the one that was faster in qualifying and didn't make a mistake. And then in the race, once he was ahead, you know, he controlled it. He was comfortably fastest. And that's not necessarily something you often see from Carlos when you think his previous wins. One was very fortuitous and one was a very strategic, like slow them down. Very clever, but not necessarily just that right pace. And yes, there was obviously time management involved. But it's a huge performance in the context of, yeah, you mentioned it, you know, 2 weeks ago he was being, you know, sliced open in a hospital in Saudi Arabia. And I think everyone's seen the videos of him walking into the paddock in Jeddah where he can barely walk. He's almost shuffling because, you know, he's just had an operation the previous day and he's in the early stages of recovery. And, yeah, he spoke on Thursday very openly saying, you know, oh, I spent the first week in bed, you know, some long days, you know, did what he could with obviously those recovery chambers you can do, special diet, but he's not doing the training that they usually do. He's not didn't do simulator sessions because he focused on his recovery. And, you know, there's a reason drivers do training. There's a reason drivers do simulator sessions. It's to put them at 100%. So he quite openly said, I will not be at 100% this weekend. So to turn up in Melbourne, put it on the front row, you know, not necessarily the most challenging track physically. You know, it's not a Singapore. It's not a Qatar. But, you know, to manage what was, you know, aside from a brief virtual safety car, a green flag race for 90 minutes, it was a thoroughly impressive performance. And you know, bringing in the context of also, you know, he's still without a drive for next year. So, you know, we're only at the end of March and he's already had, you know, big operation, lost his seat for next year. So to come out and do that kind of performance, that was top, top class.
It's purely hypothetical, and that's the best type of discussion in Formula 1, I think.
Of course.
But do you think, from what we've seen, Ferrari could have won this race straight on merit, not dominated in the way that Carlos Sainz ultimately did? The margins were always quite close, but you never got the sense that Carlos Sainz had anything other than this race in hand. Do you think he could have beaten Max Verstappen based on how we saw this race unfold?
It's or at least so have been in contention? Hard to know. I think in contention, because, yeah, it's not the hardest track at which to overtake. So track position is pretty vital. And without that rear brake problem, you know, the caliper being stuck on, Max Verstappen doesn't make the mistake that gave Carlos the lead on the second lap, effectively, when they went along the back straight in the DRS zone. It's one of the frustrations of Max retiring, and it's obviously fantastic, you know, for the spectacle and for people watching at home that, you know, it's, oh wow, someone different's going to win. But in terms of an actual race, it then made it, ironically, with the exit of Verstappen, made it a procession, whereas him being in the race probably would have made it pretty close. And, you know, Sergio Perez said afterwards, oh, Max wouldn't have won even without the brake problem, which, you know, is so hard to know when Perez's history in Melbourne, even accounting for the floor damage and the track position, is not great. It's not a Checo track. You know, it's a front limited track. It's not one that he's excelled at. So I think if Max was in the race, you know, we would have had not necessarily a battle, but I think the prospect of they're close, maybe something could happen if there was a fortuitously timed safety car, a virtual safety car, you know, if something did, well, something did happen, but if something had happened where they were close, there could have been a race for the win, you know, unlike what we saw in Bahrain and Jeddah, which was just, you know, Red Bull taking off up the road.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
There was still some strategic jeopardy in this race nonetheless, because if there's one team that started this weekend roughly as strongly as Ferrari did, it was McLaren, which looked perhaps even a little bit to their surprise, although I feel like McLaren is always surprised when it does well. That's sort of been the trend of the last year. They underestimate themselves constantly. Started very well. In fact, at the end of Friday, Oscar Piastri appeared to have potentially race-winning race pace. That's based on Friday practice. It's never definitive, but was a really good opening sign. The battle then very much became between Ferrari and McLaren. McLaren deployed Piastri to try and undercut Charles Leclerc on lap 9. Ferrari pulled in Leclerc before there could be an undercut executed, so they both moved on to a different strategy. They did get past Lando Norris, but Lando Norris had that tyre life advantage that meant, well, he was team-ordered past Oscar Piastri with better pace anyway, and then Charles Leclerc was brought in for a second undercut fundamentally. Norris couldn't finish second despite having, I guess, technically the more balanced strategy. Leclerc found that pace in that last stint. But he felt like he had the pace to potentially finish second, did Lando Norris, with an undercut of his own, essentially, rather than responding to only undercuts. Do you think that that was potentially on the table for McLaren to have finished at least second, if not first, considering that Carlos Sainz had everything so under control?
Potentially. I mean, the win wasn't there. You know, Carlos had it under control. He had a large lead and was able, you know, once he was on fresher tyres, to put quite a margin on Leclerc. I think possibly, but I think in the circumstance, third and fourth is probably the best McLaren we're going to get. You know, yeah, maybe if they'd done it slightly differently, maybe if Leclerc had been held up by a lapped car, maybe if, you know, Leclerc had been slightly slowed in the pits or had a slow out lap or something, or there's always a chance. I think on pure pace, yeah, third and fourth was the maximum they were going to get. And you know, they slightly split the strategies to give them a chance of second. But, yeah, considering the pace of the car, I think a podium and fourth place was pretty good for McLaren.
It's understandable that some teams or drivers might have felt like they got caught out here, because this is the first genuine two-stop race in Australia for quite a while. I can't even remember off the top of my head the last one, something I perhaps should have looked up earlier. But the expectations are very much...
Too many red flags last year to remember.
Well, that doesn't count, obviously, that one. Yeah. There was an uncertainty as well, because normally this is a one-stop race. The tyres were one step softer this year. The hard tyre was fairly early on in the weekend. It was clear it was going to be the backbone of strategy, which meant no one used them until the race, which gave us this great unknown quantity. We assumed we knew how that hard tyre was going to behave. It was the softer in Bahrain, I think it was, when they used the hardest compound. So we had a little bit of a view of it there, but not in this context. And, you know, I guess Leclerc's middle stint was a good example of that. He didn't understand why he wasn't as fast on it, put on another set with a little bit of lighter fuel load, and suddenly the pace in that Ferrari was unlocked a little bit, and that enabled him to secure second place. But talking about the tyres, I want to talk about Oscar Piastri briefly, because he didn't, other than that undercut on Charles Leclerc when we weren't sure exactly how this race was going to play out, and no one really wasn't in podium contention once the strategy started playing out, but was really quite close to Lando Norris on race pace. The gap between them seemed to really come from that one mistake from Piastri in the middle of the race where he locked up and went off at the second to last corner, as I think it was. How positive is that for Piastri? And I want to put this in the context of the upcoming Japanese Grand Prix. It was his first podium last year, but was way off Norris's pace. He was obliterated by Lando Norris, really, because of his tyre management. This is not a track like Japan, but tyre management was very much front and centre. Have you seen... Is that a big step for Oscar Piastri from what we've seen so far this year, that his race management has improved quite a bit?
I think it is. You know, the pace has always been there with Piastri from the very start with McLaren. He was on it from the get-go. But you're right. Ironically, some of his best performances last year, his best actual results on paper, when you think of Japan and Qatar in the race, he was significantly slower than Lando. Mm-hmm. By quite a long way, to the point where if that was on other circuits, there would have been a big gap and lots of cars between them. So he kind of got fortunate that McLaren's advantage, other than Verstappen, was such that that was almost masked. So yes, I think we've seen that through the first two races of the year, that he kind of got a handle on it, that tyre management, which is natural when you're in your second season compared to being a rookie. You come back to the same tracks. You have a set of data from last season. I think Andrea Stella talked about that in Saudi Arabia, that Oscar was just starting from a stronger baseline just because of that experience and understanding how to manage a weekend, you know, how to do FP1, FP2, FP3, build up through qualifying and then the race. But yeah, a Melbourne is very close to Lando's pace throughout the race in a tough race, which, yeah, is a two-stop race where there is tyre management, where there is degradation, where there is an unknown. So to do this in year two, and yeah, if you take out the mistake, the gap would have been, I think at that time there was 3 or 4 seconds between them. And then I think it went up to 8 or 9 with the mistakes, so it probably looked worse on paper. But yeah, I think the start of the year Oscar can be very encouraged. And yeah, you're right, Japan's next, so that would be a good test of how is he compared 2024 versus 2023.
Yeah, it'll be a really interesting race because it is one of the most extreme on tyres and tyre management. I want to look a little bit further down the order before we wrap this up, and that was the battle for minor points. For the second week in a row, some teams that weren't the top five were able to score points, and that is, I think Aya Komatsu used the phrase gold dust after Saudi Arabia because it's usually so rare. In this situation, we had two reliability problems and then George Russell half rolling his car, which we will talk about in just a second as well, that opened up 3 points paying places. They were scored by Yuki Tsunoda and both Haas drivers, Nico Hülkenberg ahead of Kevin Magnussen. Now, Alex Albon came close to putting Williams in the points. That had been his target after getting Logan Sargeant's chassis given to him after practice, after he crashed his own one and Williams revealed they didn't have an extra one. He tried to undercut his way past Kevin Magnussen, did work early in the race. Eventually, Magnussen had the pace to put some really, gutsy attempts on him and eventually moved past into what became 10th place. And that combined with Nico Hülkenberg, as I said, who moved up thanks to that virtual safety car on lap 17 to secure double points. This is the second week in a row, very different race for Haas, second week in the row, but the second week in the row in which the team has been really astute with strategy. The team didn't start on the cusp of the top 10 like it did last week. It was firmly in the midfield but moved forward. I mean, how positive is that? I guess more broadly, where are you rating Haas at this point in the year, considering they've come off a pretty low base last season, which they were sketchy on track and sometimes in terms of execution? From what we've seen in the last two races, and in Melbourne in particular, how buoyed can you be that actually this is a perhaps one of the strongest midfield teams?
I think Haas can be very encouraged because pre-season, I think everyone thought this is a team that really struggled in 2023. They didn't understand, honestly didn't understand, but the big update didn't address many, or if any, of the problems, you know, and then the drivers were split on which one was better, and they go into the winter still looking for answers. And having said, you know, they were very, very open and said, look, we will start the season slowly because this is effectively the Austin car kind of remodeled a little bit, but we don't want to put updates on it until we think we can understand it because we don't want to go down the wrong path. So they said, look, we're going to be last.
Yeah.
And then you're thinking, oh God, they're going to, after last season where they kind of started all right and then slipped back with the tyre degradation problems, you're thinking, are they just going to spend the whole year circling around at the back? And it's only 4 points across two races, or you know, three races. But I think that's 4 points more than anyone thought would be possible. And Jeddah was a little bit fortunate. They played the strategy very well. But this was done on pace. This was done on good teamwork. This is done on strategy. You know, they came from 14th and 16th to finish 9th and 10th. And yes, three cars retired. And yes, Sauber had a problem, another problem in the pit stop with Valtteri Bottas. Alpine had a problem with the tear-off getting stuck in Esteban Ocon's brake duct, which kind of took him out of contention when he might have been in that points mix. But what Ayo Komatsu said after the race is, you've got to be there. And that's where Haas are now. You know, they are there. They are towards the front of, you know, the front of the back of the midfield, whatever we're calling it, that second group, you know, Formula B, if you want. Can't call it Formula 2. There's already that category. But, you know, I think Kevin Magnussen said it well, whereby last year, you know, they woke up, came to the track, and wherever they'd qualified, they knew they were probably going to slip back and end up circling around at the back, whereas this year, they know they can race. And obviously that's motivating for the drivers. It's motivating for the whole team. You know, you saw Magnussen overtook Albon on track in the last stint. You know, that wouldn't have happened 6 months ago. So that's the progress they've made. And it's only 9th and 10th, but it's double points for the first time since Austria 2022. So it is a milestone. You know, we're not talking about, wow, 3 points. That's a huge difference. But this is way better than I think anyone would have anticipated pre-season, considering just how awful the back end of 2023 was and how that morale had nosedived so much.
Yeah, and again, in that context of being relatively few points paying places in the average Grand Prix, let's say, for those bottom five teams, to occupy two of them when one of them might have been taken by another team, a rival team, very valuable from that perspective as well. Just to wrap this one up, I want to touch on Fernando Alonso's penalty after the race. Had it been a more harsh penalty, maybe Alex Albon would have found himself in the top 10, but he didn't. He finished 11th. This was for not causing a collision, but for erratic driving, triggering George Russell's big crash that ended the race under virtual safety car. Russell kind of implied it was a brake test. You can understand looking at both the stewards' investigation, if anyone's seen the onboard or the telemetry, there was an early brake and then Fernando Alonso getting back on the throttle and then braking for turn six. So I can understand that perspective. The stewards decided it was actually more just unpredictable, erratic driving. They used the word extraordinary, which is extraordinary. How did you read this as a defensive manoeuvre? I think two laps from the finish as it was at the time. Both Mercedes-powered cars, Fernando Alonso in the twilight of his years, a world champion, maybe once one of the Mercedes, well, the Lewis Hamilton Mercedes seat. I mean, just how did you read this move from him?
Well, I mean, at first, I kind of didn't really notice it. I don't think many people really noticed it because you kind of thought, oh, George closed on him quite a lot through the corner, and then obviously you lose the downforce. But then when they were summoned to the stewards and you look at it again and you think, yeah, that does look unusual. And then you see the telemetry and you think, that is a bit odd. I think if there's any other driver involved, you kind of would have written it off. But because we know the history of Fernando Alonso is, he does look for any advantage anywhere and is so clever with knowing the rule book, with knowing strategy, with knowing how the other drivers operate. You know, his mental capacity is so vast that you suddenly think, oh, maybe, but I don't know. It's a weird one because you can't lie with the data. You can't, you know, you can't argue with the telemetry and what it says that he was, you know, braked, was it 100 meters earlier?
Yeah.
They flicked down a gear where he'd never had before. So, but the kind of intention of, was it because he wanted to get a good exit from the corner, which is what he said to the stewards, which we have to believe him.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we do or not, you know, whether that is the truth, who knows, but that's what he says. It makes sense in terms of trying to get the best exit possible from that corner because it's then the DRS zone along the back straight. I don't see how you can believe his actions were deliberate in terms of getting George to crash because I don't think he would think that because these are the best guys in the world. And yes, George got caught out, but I don't think Fernando would have expected, oh, here's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
I'm going to try and get him to crash at turn six and that's him done.
Yes.
Maybe he was thinking, I'll catch him out a little bit or something, but I don't know. It's a weird one and it's kind of now an unusual precedent being set because I don't recall. Obviously, we've seen drivers penalised for dangerous and erratic driving that was so obvious, you know, weaving or what you would call a deliberate brake test or... Or even using your car as, you know, driving into someone.
Yes.
As we have seen before. Very rarely, but we have seen it. But I don't recall anyone being punished for kind of going a bit too slowly through a corner. So, yeah, it's a weird one. And I think it'll be interesting to see what Fernando says in Suzuka when he will inevitably be asked for his thoughts. I can't imagine they're going to be, you know... restrained.
No, it will be
interesting. Or maybe they'll be restrained, but with, you know, quite the attitude.
Yes, with quite dripping subtext, I suspect. He's already said on social media that he strongly disagrees with it, but he did admit on social media that he told the stewards he'd admitted to making a mistake by braking so early. So there is sort of additional elements to it, but we'll wait and see in Japan how he settles that one. This was how the Australian Grand Prix was settled, though. A rare non-Red Bull Racing, rare non-Max Verstappen victory to Carlos Sainz. Sans his appendix. Sometimes weight does make all the difference, doesn't it, Phil? Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much, Michael.
It's just the race that Formula One needed after two rounds of off-track turmoil and on-track domination by Max Verstappen. Ferrari and McLaren might not be close enough to make a contest of the championship, but Melbourne proved that in the right circumstances, they can race for victories. Red Bull Racing has a tiny weakness. The challenge for 2024 is to exploit it. Thanks very much to Phil Horton for joining me to debrief the Australian Grand Prix. Subscribe to The Strategy Report wherever you get your favourite podcasts, and if you enjoy the show, we'd love it if you could give us a rating and a review. The Strategy Report is a Beer Mogul podcast on the Evergreen Podcast Network. Special thanks to Ben Loke from Bloke Designs for the show artwork, and our theme music is by Simon Hosford. My name's Michael Laminato, and I'll catch you in a couple of weeks for the Japanese Grand Prix.
Get ready, race fans, because the ultimate NASCAR experience is about to hit the airwaves. Welcome to Pit Pass NASCAR, the podcast that takes you deep into the heart-pounding world of NASCAR racing.
Join us each week as we bring you closer to the NASCAR action with exclusive interviews and all the news and rumors you need with your favorite drivers, team members, and industry insiders.
So whether you're a fan of super speedways, short ovals, or road racing, or you've just watched Talladega Nights, Pit Pass NASCAR is the podcast you've been waiting for.
Get ready to fuel your passion for NASCAR like never before. Subscribe now to Pit Pass NASCAR on your favorite podcast platform or head to evergreenpodcast.com and get ready to join us.
Launching in the fall on Evergreen Podcast Network. Follow us on social media at pitpass_NASCAR to stay up to date with everything you need to know about the podcast.